In 2009, the New York City police made approximately 341,000 adult arrests. Three-quarters of them were for misdemeanors, and most of the defendants were men under the age of 30. The five most frequently charged offenses at arraignment were criminal possession of marijuana, assault in the third degree, possession of drugs other than marijuana, shoplifting, and theft of services, most typically turnstile jumping. What happens to the accused after they're arrested for misdemeanors is the subject of a new study by Human Rights Watch called The Price of Freedom, Bail and Pretrial Detention of Low-Income Non-Felony Defendants in New York City. And here to discuss how the accused are treated is Jamie Fellner, Senior Counsel at Human Rights Watch. Welcome to our show.
Glad to be here.
Is it a recent development that the majority of arrests are for misdemeanors and not felonies?
Well, it's the percentage of misdemeanor arrests has been increasing, especially with the initiative started under Giuliani to go after so-called quality of life arrests. So the proportion of felonies, more serious crimes, has been dropping.
And the argument was if you arrest people for these crimes, you're likely to find to be arresting the same people who are going to go on and commit felonies.
Well, I've always had problems with that argument. I mean, that's assuming that everybody who smokes marijuana in public is going to grow up to be a murderer, or everybody who jumps a turnstile is going to be. Now, they have one case where a turnstile jumper did, in fact, murder someone, and they always cite it. But there's no data to suggest going after these people has any effect on subsequent crime rates.
What percentage of the people arrested in 2009 on misdemeanor charges had no prior convictions?
Oh, Leonard, I don't have that piece of data in front of me.
Well, I do, actually.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Good.
60.4% had no prior felony convictions, and 47.4% had no prior misdemeanor convictions. So we're talking hovering 50 to 60%.
Right. But a lot of those, and the city is correct in pointing out that a lot of people who are arrested on misdemeanors have long rap sheets. But, you know, the rap sheet shouldn't have anything to do with what happens to you at arraignment. After you're arrested, the first time you go before a judge is at arraignment. And if the case isn't disposed of at arraignment, if the prosecutor doesn't drop the case or you don't take a plea, which many people do, then the judge in a misdemeanor case has to decide bail or release.
Don't one half of all criminal cases end at arraignment?
They do. That's
a high percentage, isn't it?
It's a very high percentage. It's a good thing because the criminal justice system in New York City would fall apart if people insisted on their right to trial. There's enormous pressure to plead. Enormous.
Yeah, the defendant either pleads guilty to a charge, or because the case is dismissed or adjourned in contemplation of dismissal.
Right.
Those are the reasons it ends.
Right.
But people, you're saying that that they're often pressured to take a plea?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that 99% of convictions of misdemeanors for misdemeanor crimes occur through a plea. There's enormous pressure to take a plea.
Is the plea deal the best outcome for someone with no prior convictions?
Well, that all depends. I mean, if the plea deal involves dropping the misdemeanor down to a violation like a disorderly conduct, so it won't be on, in theory, won't be on their record, it might be okay. The plea deal might be good, except a lot of this has changed because of the immigration laws. You might be a non-citizen here legally, though. You get convicted of smoking marijuana in public and you get convicted of a misdemeanor, you're suddenly facing deportation. So the rules of the game have changed considerably.
Well, if you have taken a plea for a misdemeanor, isn't that something you have to reveal on a job application?
I haven't applied for a job in a long time, but it's certainly if you have been convicted, whether it's through a plea or through a trial, normally you'll be asked if you have some kind of record, whether you have to reveal a violation. I think most people feel they have to reveal it. They might not be eligible for public housing. There are a lot of collateral consequences.
You mentioned that one of the reasons that people are pressured to take a plea, and this is often by the public defender who's supposedly representing you in your best interest, is because otherwise the courts would just be too clogged. And would that also mean that we'd be spending a lot more money on these cases?
You know, the criminal courts in New York City face this problem. The police keep sending them these, you know, a tsunami of low-level cases. The whole system would bog down. There are not enough judges, there are not enough prosecutors, there are not enough public defense attorneys to handle all the cases if they took more than 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, which is what happens now. Defense attorneys also know because they've been around, and the prosecutors know because they've been around, and the judges know what the likely outcome in any given case is going to be. And there are variations, but my research suggests that defense attorneys call it pretty well whether the judge is likely to release you on your own recognizance, meaning you just promise you'll come back, or to impose bail. The thing is that everybody also knows that chances are if bail is imposed, you won't be able to make it right then, and you're going to go to Rikers.
Do you think that the rapid-fire plea bargains, which take place in hundreds of thousands of low-level drug cases across the country, are a problem that can be remedied without spending a lot of money?
The only way to remedy them would be to have far fewer arrests so that more time could be spent truly considering the facts of each case and maybe having more trials. As it stands now, hardly anybody in a misdemeanor case has a trial. It just doesn't happen.
Well, what happens to the defendant if the case does not end at arraignment?
The case doesn't end at arraignment. Either they'll be released on their own recognizance or bail is set. If they're released on their own recognizance, there will be a series of court appearances that will drag on until the defendant either agrees to a plea or the prosecutor drops the case.
Is there a standard dollar amount of bail for each of the misdemeanor offenses mentioned earlier, like criminal possession of marijuana, assault in the third degree, shoplifting, theft of services, turnstile jumping?
No, unlike a lot of jurisdictions, New York City doesn't have a sort of schedule of bail amounts. It's up to the judge to set, has remarkably broad discretion, and a lot depends on the prior record, whether there is reason to believe the defendant will return to court. Because in New York, and it's important to emphasize, in New York City, in New York State, the only reason to set bail is to get the defendant to come back to court. It's not a public safety measure.
In your report, you note, you tell the story of John F., a 23-year-old black man who was arrested in Brooklyn for walking between subway train cars. He had no prior arrests but had 6 prior summonses for having an unleashed dog. And the judge set bail at $500. That's a lot of money for somebody who sounds like you and me.
It's a lot of money for someone who I suspect has a lot fewer resources than you and me.
Why so high? Why $500?
You know, I wasn't there enough to evaluate or review. And judges can do that. They might have been pissed at the guy. I would say, why did the police bother to arrest him? Now, the police say walking between subway cars is something gang members do while they're—
I've walked between subway cars.
Shame on you. They think people do it to check out who might be worth robbing. What the police are doing is trying to get the fingerprints of lots of Hispanic and black men in New York City. And that really is the bottom line. They feel that's a way that then they can keep tabs on them. It's a form of social control. It has very little to do with crime control.
So this guy, his mother came up with the $500. But what percentage of the people who are accused of a misdemeanor are kept in detention? A misdemeanor, which is a very minor crime, are kept in detention, wind up going to jail because they can't meet bail?
87%. 87%.
That's Rikers Island mostly?
Will go mostly to Rikers. They'll spend an average of 15 days there. A lot will be released after, some will come up with bail within the first day or two. The rest will stay there until probably for 5 days. And I can explain why 5 days is a sort of magic number. Some stay there for months and months and months. Most people end up taking a plea.
I've been to Rikers Island as a visitor. And I wouldn't want to spend 5 minutes there if I didn't have to.
That's why lots of people plea. If the choice is going to Rikers or taking a plea, they'll plea.
But this is not unique to New York City, is it?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, New York City does pretty well in terms of the number of people released on their own recognizance. But the problem of money being an impediment to pretrial freedom exists across the country.
According to the Bureau of Justice statistics of the U.S. Department of Justice, 62% of the nation's jail population consists of unconvicted detainees. And in the nation's 75 largest counties, 37% of felony defendants are held on bail until case disposition. The Pretrial Justice Institute estimates that it costs $9 billion annually just to incarcerate defendants held on bail.
It's a huge problem. New York City, the cost, we estimate that the city would save $42 million just in 1 year if it were not incarcerating these low-level offenders who've been accused but not convicted of these minor offenses.
But do we want to free them all? I mean, isn't the problem how do we determine which ones are safe and which ones aren't?
Again, it's not about safety. It's about who will return to court. And most people, in fact, do return to court. The statistics suggest that over 90% return to court. If they miss one appointment, a court appearance, scheduled court appearance, they'll come back voluntarily in a few days or within the month.
Because the alternative is to be accused of a more serious crime, which is not appearing in court. And then you can get real jail time for that.
Can't you? Can be arrested then for not appearing in court.
But if you – okay. So let's say you have jumped a turnstile and you don't post bail and you don't plead guilty, how long a sentence would you get for that?
You're going to get
$2.25?
It's really going to depend on if you have a prior record what the actual sentence will be. But in most cases, in half the cases, when there is a sentence, it doesn't include any jail time. I mean, we have people going to Rikers who, that's the only reason they're in jail, because afterwards they're going to be the case dismissed or they'll be found innocent, rarely, because most cases end in some kind of guilty plea, guilty disposition. But these are cases that are – they're nickel and dime cases, and they get nickel and dime sentences.
And in 2009, there were 98,980 total admissions to New York City's jails. That's nearly 100,000 people, a little more than half of which, 51,000 or so, were pretrial detainees incarcerated solely because they hadn't posted bail. That's an extraordinary number.
Yeah. My figure is that 39% of the entire population at any given moment at Rikers, that includes felonies and non-felony, people charged with felonies and non-felonies, are there because they couldn't pay bail.
So this is called financial bail?
Well, actually, it's called money bail, but it means most people, when they say bail, they think of either cash or a bond. And commercial bondsmen don't take on cases of 1,000 or less. It's not worth their while financially. So we have people who are struggling to make ends meet, and the court asks them for $500 or $1,000. They don't have it.
A caller said that he was arrested for possession of marijuana, and while he has worked to get it expunged, it was put on the police blotter. And so any future employer can Google his name and we'll find it, and it won't be removed from the police blotter.
He was convicted of a misdemeanor. If it were had been reduced to disorderly conduct, then it shouldn't be on the police blotter.
Well, I want to talk about drug policy after we take a little break. My guest is Jamie Fellner, senior counsel at Human Rights Watch. We're talking about what happens if you can't post bail and you don't cop a plea. The Human Rights Watch published a study based on 2009 records called The Price of Freedom, Bail and Pretrial Detention of Low-Income Non-Felony Defendants in New York City. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back with Jamie Fellner, who is senior counsel at Human Rights Watch. We're talking about bail and related matters, you have been critical of the war on drugs. Don't drugs create serious problems? We just spoke with Dave Itzkoff, whose father was a cocaine addict, and it could have ruined the family if his father didn't make a lot of money.
There's no question that drugs can ruin people's lives. The issue is, what do we do about it? And what this country's been doing is criminalizing it, criminalizing possession, criminalizing sale. And there are many people who believe, and I'm frankly quite persuaded by the facts they cite, that the war on drugs has caused more harm than good. There are other ways to respond to illness besides sending people to jail, which, by the way, as you probably know, has had absolutely no effect on how many people use drugs or how much they cost.
And a new national poll reveals that 65% of Americans, Republicans and Democrats, think that the war on drugs effort has been a failure. Do you have any idea why it's been such a failure?
Well, because I think it's based on the wrong premise. People have been using substances of all sorts for recreational purposes since time immemorial. To criminalize certain of those substances flies in the face of, you know, straight sort of market function. As long as there's a demand, which there is, there will be a supply. And by criminalizing it, it means that the suppliers resort to violence. Look what's going on in Mexico because of the huge profits that can be made. And those profits are simply due to the fact that it's illegal.
Hasn't most research proved that blacks and whites engage in drug offenses at roughly similar rates?
Absolutely.
Why then are black men entering state prison on drug charges at more than 10 times the rate of white men? And your research uncovers the disproportionate number of minorities who are both arrested and detained who are unable to post bond.
Well, we can answer that question by looking in New York City. Where do the police go to arrest people for drugs? They're not in my neighborhood. They're not up on Park Avenue. They're in areas with a high concentration of Hispanic and black residents. And if that's where you're going to look for drugs, that's where you'll find them, even though we know that drugs are plentiful at white prep schools and in offices and private clubs.
At Columbia University, we discovered recently?
At Columbia University. So police are enforcing the law, but they're enforcing it in certain neighborhoods. The collateral consequences from drugs from the fact that drugs are illegal may be most acutely felt in those neighborhoods too, because there's been gang violence, for example. But again, the question is, would that violence diminish? And could we take the money that goes now into the war on drugs and put it into public health treatment, making treatment more affordable, more education? In the end of the day, that might cost a whole lot less, and we wouldn't have a shredded Fourth Amendment, and we wouldn't have our jails and prisons full. One-third of all people in New York State jails are there sent to there on drug charges.
You say the shreds the Fourth Amendment. You say the war on drugs violates both the Fourth Amendment and the Eighth Amendment?
It has led to violations of the Fourth Amendment as
which
the
court.
That's the right to be protected from unreasonable search and seizure. And the searches, the courts have just, you know, anytime the police have argued that we need to be able to do this to go after drugs, the police have backed off. So there's very little privacy left now because of the drug war on drugs.
And the Eighth Amendment is
cruel
and
unusual.
Unusual punishment.
Right.
And you think that sending somebody to jail for drug, are we talking about all drugs? Are we talking about marijuana is quite different from heroin and cocaine, isn't it?
Well, in terms of its effects or in terms of how it's treated by the law?
All of those things. And then there are other drugs that seem to be wiping out whole areas of the country.
Drugs are really tricky business because people keep inventing new drugs faster than the police can, you know, come up with laws making them illegal, or the states can make them illegal. Marijuana has—
Methamphetamine is destroyed whole areas of
methamphetamine is a very bad drug. There's no question about it. And I think it may be helpful to distinguish between marijuana, which quite frankly is not a very bad drug. It is not a gateway drug. It is no more a gateway than Coca-Cola is or than wine is a gateway to—it's just bad numbers. But again, the question is, how do we deal with more harmful drugs? Do we regulate them? Do we make them illegal to possess? And that is a conversation the country hasn't been willing to have.
In a recent article in the New York Times, John Elegon reported that complaints against bail bondsmen are on the rise. The whole system seems to need an overhaul, doesn't it? When someone cannot raise bail, even $100, they turn to a bondsman. And who regulates the bail bondsman?
Nobody. Effectively nobody. The courts don't. The insurance industry doesn't. And there are a lot of stories across the country of shady practices, of abuses. But I think the more fundamental question is, why should pretrial freedom depend on whether you can afford to pay cash bail or whether you can afford to buy a surety bond from a bail bondsman? The bail bondsmen take 10%. And even if you show up in court, make all your hearings, even if you're found innocent, you've lost that 10%. That's a lot of money, can be a lot of money.
The most common complaint of defendants who use bondsmen in New York to post bail is that the bondsman keeps some or all of the collateral that they give them for unnecessary or invented services.
Well, by law, the amount that bondsmen can charge in fees is regulated, a certain percentage. But the collateral fees are not regulated very closely, if at all. And there's a lot, it would seem, of hanky-panky that's happening there.
And the bondsmen actually charge for rearresting. They seem to be able to rearrest their clients for almost any real or imagined infraction.
I was surprised to read that. But again, they have a financial incentive in all of this. It's... Again, the American Bar Association thinks that there shouldn't be commercial bond because all the incentives go against the fundamental fairness and integrity of the criminal justice system. There are four states that don't permit commercial bonds, and the United States and the Philippines are the only two countries we know of that permit commercial bonds.
One bondsman who's quoted in that story in the New York Times, Mr. Zuvelos, actually returned 89 people whom he had bailed out. Some of them had not missed a court appearance or done anything wrong.
Yeah, he sounds like he's got some real problems. Now, there are bad apples in every barrel. And I don't know if bondsman in New York City, if he's unusual or not. But again, I think the underlying concern is why do we have this industry at all?
And some of the bail contracts are 15 pages long, would require a lawyer to review them. Has it always been that way?
It's always been a somewhat unseemly, unregulated business. I mean, stories of bounty hunters. You know, a bounty hunter who's the person the bail bondsman sends to go after you if you've, absconded on the bail. They can break into your house. They can go into your house without a warrant, which the police can't do.
So we have this problem. Let's say somebody who doesn't have a lot of money but has a little bit of collateral is arrested. They can cop a plea. They can go to jail or they can go to a bail bondsman.
Well, again, they can't go to a bail bondsman if it's if they're looking at a bail of $1,000 or less. Bail bondsman won't take it.
So now, the people – so in other words, the misdemeanor person is less likely to be able to get
absolutely.
Help?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, this all could be taken care of if the judges – which the judges have the authority under state law to set bond in the form of what's called an unsecured appearance bond, in which the person says, if I don't show up, I'll owe this money. But they never use that.
Well, in your report, you quote former Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, who said this quite a while ago. I'm going to read it. It's a bit long.
Yeah, it's a great quote.
After arrest, the accused who is poor must often await the disposition of his case in jail because of his inability to raise bail, while the accused who can afford bail is free to return to his family and job. This is an example of justice denied, of a man imprisoned for no reason other than his poverty. Think of the needless waste to the individual, the family, and the community every time a responsible person, presumed by a law to be innocent, is kept in jail awaiting trial solely because he's unable to raise bail money. Now, he said that a while back, and I'm sure many people have agreed, and yet nothing seems to be happening to change the situation.
Well, bail and the sort of role of money in pretrial freedom is a longstanding problem. It's ironic that New York City, which was sort of the birthplace of bail reform, did a number of things that were right. And we see that today in the fact that so many people are released on their own recognizance, which wasn't the case 40 years ago. But it hasn't tackled the question of whether money should itself be the touchstone for release. Many states have set up pretrial release supervision programs so that you are not put in jail just because you can't pay for it. In fact, under federal law, judges aren't supposed to set a bail that will result in your detention.
We got a comment on our show page from Brian from Greenwood. He said, I was a legal aid lawyer for 12 years in Manhattan. What Ms. Fellner says about bail is the law, but not the practice. If one looks at the CJ system, not as a system of adjudication, but part of a system of public order that is, as Ms. Fellner says, mostly responsible for the volume of public order arrests, it's quite successful. Bail is used to punish primarily poor and minority folks. Clearly, the arrest of the guy going between cars and the bail set had everything to do with his perceived race, class, status.
I think a lot of people would agree with that statement.
Now, why is that? I mean, don't we expect our judges to not be racially biased?
It's not just a racial bias. Most of the people who are arrested are Black and Hispanic. Most of the people arrested, four-fifths of them for misdemeanors, are Black and Hispanics. And the rate of release on recognizance or bail is about that. So the judges aren't making decisions there that are racially biased. The whole system, I think the entire criminal justice system, falls more heavily on people who are poor. And people who are poor tend to be Blacks and Hispanics.
Now, Carla from Brooklyn is slapping us on the wrist. She writes, as a person of color and a former prosecutor, these sorts of discussions are always disappointing, particularly where the guest speakers are white. Leaving drug offenses aside, there is never any discussion of the persons who are the victims of the crimes, even if misdemeanors, who are also overwhelmingly Black or Hispanic. For many of these victims, the fact that the accused is on Rikers can offer some sense of relief.
I think there's no question that that's something to be taken into consideration when we're looking at crimes of violence or domestic violence. But remember, I'm not sure who the victim is when it's jumping turnstiles or smoking marijuana in public. Obviously, shoplifting is costing the shops money, and it should be dealt with. I'm not suggesting it shouldn't be dealt with. My concern is simply if somebody is not released on their own recognizance, and there may be very good reasons. I'm not challenging those statistics. I'm saying once we know this person is going to proceed with a case, should they have to sit in Rikers simply because they're poor?
So you're saying in some cases judges have a good reason to keep them in jail, but in many other cases, they simply should change the way they go about doing these things.
There may be good reasons for judges to fear that some of these people won't return to court. Judges, unfortunately, don't have the option of some kind of supervised release program where they could keep them out of jail but make sure they return.
Jamie Fellner is senior counsel at Human Rights Watch. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
It was my pleasure.
Claims that the revolution will be tweeted may not always be the case. On tomorrow's show, we'll look at whether the internet may turn out to be more of a boon to authoritarian governments. And then comic Pat Cooper on his life and career. Also, there are many cliches in professional sports, from the home field advantage, the claim that defense wins championships. We'll look into those notions and others with a behavioral economist. Plus, James Miller on his collection of short biographies of 12 influential philosophers from Socrates to Nietzsche. The Let It Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Todd McGovern and Angela Sheldon. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Let It Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.